From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in February when the Monroe County Democratic Party endorsed Shawnee Curry Mitchell for district attorney. Curry Mitchell is a former assistant DA who now works as a municipal attorney for the city of Rochester. She's a native Rochesterian who has worked not only as a prosecutor but as a solo practitioner in civil cases. She represents the Rochester Police Department in professional standards cases. She's been the president of the Rochester Black Bar Association, and she's an active member of the foundation of the Monroe County Bar Association. Now she wants to become the next district attorney. Her platform includes some significant changes compared to the practices carried out by the incumbent, Sandra Dorley. Ms. Dorley will join us in studio on this program about 2 weeks from now. Today is our first chance to sit down with the Democratic challenger in this contest, and we always seek to have both, if we can, throughout a campaign, at-length conversations individually with people who are running for office, and then when we can bring them together for conversations, we try to do that too. Shawnee Curry Mitchell, welcome. Thank you for being here. Well, it's wonderful to have you in studio. And listeners, if you want to follow along and learn more, we also always direct our listeners to all campaign websites if you want to learn more. Again, not to endorse, but just to offer more information. It's ShawneeCurryMitchell.com. Shawnee is S-H-A-N-I. You are a native Rochesterian.
Yes, I am.
Where'd you grow up?
Grew up on the southwest side of the city, graduate of Wilson Magnet High School. Grew up in the home of Archie and Annie Curry. My father, Archie Curry, was a public servant here, was on the Board of Education, Rochester Board of Education, for 17 years. After I left Wilson Magnet High School, I attended Spelman College in Atlanta, Georgia, and then went on to Florida State University College of Law. But I began my practice of law in Atlanta, Georgia, in the DA's office there.
All right. We'll talk as we go throughout the program about what it was that brought you back here and some of the work you've done here. But going back to your childhood, what are your early memories of Rochester, particularly with obviously very active parents, a dad who was serving? What are your early memories?
I just knew that Rochester was a community that was warm and inviting. For me, I mean, my community was pretty much the southwest side of the city. But I knew that was a city that had endured a lot of change, and it was still changing. But it was a city that could endure the change, but was willing to do what it needed to do to grow and to accept those things that are and those people who are different. That's what I remember. It was a city that was constantly growing, and I was happy to be a part of it.
Was it a happy time growing up?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. My parents created a wonderful home for myself and my siblings, and we were exposed to any and everything that life had to offer. So it was a great upbringing.
And you end up in the in Florida getting your law degree and then working in Georgia. And I wonder if it was the climate that brought you back. Before we get back to that, what was it like working in Georgia?
It was a wonderful experience. I was I began practicing in the DA's office. Now, the DA's office in Atlanta only handles felony cases. They have a separate office that handles misdemeanors, which is different than we have here in New York State. So it was great. It was a progressive office even then in the late 90s, early 2000s. This is my 20th year practicing law. It was a very community-centered office. We had community prosecution. We had discretion. I mean, there was a time where I had a case where someone was charged with armed robbery, and it was a one witness case, and it was a male who said, "This is the individual who did it." That's pretty much all the evidence we had. The individual then said, through his attorney, provided an alibi. Through my investigator, we tried to break the alibi. Sat down with my supervisor, said, "I don't believe this is the guy." They trusted me to make that decision, and unfortunately, this victim didn't have the resolution they were looking for, but I was not going to convict somebody I didn't believe I could prove was, in fact, guilty of the crime. But that was the kind of office that I was in at the time.
And just kind of keying on that point, I suspect you're raising that story because that is In contrast to how maybe some, or at least the public perception of some DA's offices, I don't say that to cast aspersions.
No.
But there, a lot has been written about the idea that once a case comes to prosecution, the goal is to win it.
That is not what the job of a district attorney is. The job is to seek justice. And if you do not believe that the person in front of you is guilty of the crime, it is your job to ensure that justice is held. Unfortunately, I felt bad for the victim. You know, he believed, and this was before whole cross-racial identification was an issue or raised, but there was an alibi that my investigator, who was a senior investigator, who had been part of the Fulton County Police Department for a number of years, his alibi was solid. And it was in my supervisor trusted me and my investigator, and we dismissed the case, outright dismissed. We didn't force him to plead to something less. He was dismissed. And probably about a year or two later, he happened to be coming through the courthouse, tapped me on my shoulder, and just said, thank you. He said, are you Miss Curry? I said, yes. You know, you get a little leery when you're in the courtroom. And he said, thank you. That absolutely changed the trajectory of my life. When people have charges on them, it changes everything. It affects their family, their employee, and everything else. So I knew that what I was doing was right. And that's in the end. That's what we are. That's what the district attorney's office is about. In the end, you know what you are doing, you're confident in what you're doing, and that you're doing seeking justice and making sure we're not putting away innocent people, but we do want to protect victims. And you do feel bad that the police didn't necessarily get it right that time. But you're given the case and the facts that are presented to you.
You ended up leaving Georgia after how many years? How long were you there?
I was there 12 years.
Okay. What was it that brought you back here?
I had a desire to teach. While I was in Georgia, I obtained my master's degree in criminal justice because I absolutely love this criminal justice system with all its flaws. I believe in what it can be. And I wanted to study the wealth of information that's out there about the system and how it works, where it works, which cities get it right, which cities don't, and why they don't. And so I obtained my master's from Boston University, and I wanted to teach at a four-year institution. So I left hot Atlanta for Canton, New York, where I taught at SUNY Canton for over 3+ years. And then after that, in 2013, I took the bar exam, New York State bar exam, at the age of 40, and then moved back home and took the job at the district attorney's office here in Monroe County.
And worked as an assistant district attorney for about 5 years?
5+ years, yes.
5+ years. All of those years with Sandra Dorley as district attorney, is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And now you're challenging Sandra Dorley for that job. And let's start with some of the reasons. What motivated you to run? What is chief among the reasons for you to decide to pursue this job?
Well, I believe that there's a standard of justice that is set by your district attorney. And that's what the district attorney's job is, to set the standard of justice. And I believe that standard isn't set. And I believe that we can, the policies that are implemented currently are not for the betterment of Monroe County. And I believe that the policies that I will set will benefit all of Monroe County.
We'll get specific because her platform and her website has a lot of information. Listeners, we also have some questions that have already come in. But listeners, if you want to call the program, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program, connections@WXXI.org. Our guest for the hour is Shawnee Curry Mitchell, who is the Democrat running for Monroe County District Attorney. The incumbent running for re-election is Sandra Dorley, and she'll be on this program a couple of weeks from now. So when you remember that experience you had in Atlanta, when you went to your superiors and essentially said, I believe this is not the guy, and that the right thing to do is to dismiss, not to pursue the case, not to try to get him to plead down, to dismiss. Could that happen here in this district attorney's office?
I have had experiences where I've felt uncomfortable with the response that I was given when such situations were brought to my attention, when I had a file, and I was uncomfortable with the manner in which I was instructed to prosecute it. And so I'm going to say no with my experiences. I can't talk about anyone else's, okay? A straight-out dismissal has never happened in the 5 years for me. Again, I'm not talking about anyone else.
How many cases do you think? Just sort of kind of guessing here.
Well, I started off like everyone else, or mostly everyone else, in misdemeanors. So misdemeanors, you carry hundreds of cases at a time, okay? So you multiply that by three plus years in misdemeanors plus another, maybe 500 cases? I mean,
no dismissals.
Or more? Not one.
Should there have been dismissals?
Yes, absolutely. There were times when I was instructed to offer something less. And so there were battles. You get tired of fighting. And so that was one of the reasons why I left. The opportunity arose where it was a perfect storm. But there were battles in the office, and I just couldn't continue to battle over what I thought to be the right thing to do.
Okay.
So, no, there's, in my caseload, I've never dismissed a case.
I'm asking this because I don't exactly know the procedure behind the scenes, how it would work. So if you had a concern about a case that maybe should result in a dismissal, is that something you take directly to the district attorney herself?
No, you take it to your superior.
Okay.
Your deputy or...
Because if our listeners are envisioning you and perhaps District Attorney Dorley...
No, there's no battle with Sandra Dorley.
Okay.
With myself.
Okay.
I don't know about anyone else.
Okay. I appreciate that clarification. Mm-hmm. But did you ever go to her directly to say, look, you are the one who sets the policy in the office, and I think that occasionally we're getting it wrong?
That's not how that office works.
What do you mean by that?
I don't want to spend much time on that, but I would just say that Shawnee Curry Mitchell, didn't have that kind of access to Sandra Dorley.
But you're working in the office.
I, Shawnee Curry Mitchell, did not have that kind of access to Sandra Dorley.
Okay. So those conversations didn't happen directly. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. And I'm getting from you, and I understand the point, that you want to talk about what you want to do.
Absolutely.
And I respect that. So let me just ask one final question on that, and then we're going to spend the bulk of the hour on your proposals.
Okay.
Do you think the access to the district attorney was based on just ranking, politics, or something else?
Let me say, when I worked in Atlanta, all I had to do was dial his number, and I could get a meeting.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay. I do suspect she will dispute that characterization.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. But that's your experience.
Absolutely.
Okay. Our guest, Shawnee Curry Mitchell, it's shawneecurrymitchell.com if you want to learn more about her. And we'll have Sandra Dorley on the program in a couple of weeks. The Democrat running for Monroe County District Attorney. We have seen the party welcome a number of people who have run, and just the last 12 months have been very active in the party. And there's a lot of people, there's a lot of men, women, there's a lot of women of color in the law. How did you find yourself thinking, you know, this is the job I want right now? And what was the reception with the local Democratic Party to that?
They were very excited about me seeking this office based upon my experience and my qualifications. They were excited to back me, you know, for this office. Absolutely. I've had over 13 years of prosecutorial experience, and this is my 20th year practicing law. I also know the defense side because not only as a private attorney, I also defended individuals, plus the experience of having my master's degree and also teaching criminal justice. You can't dispute what I know about the criminal justice system.
One of our listeners, before the program began, just sent a note saying that your website notes that you've done some work with the Rochester Police Department. And I think professional standards, I'm trying to remember, but can you clarify for listeners
Sure.
what that is? Yeah.
Under my current position, the professional standards section is the equivalent of internal affairs. And so you have individual who have police officers who are being investigated for misconduct. So as a municipal attorney, the municipal attorney, if the case goes to a hearing on the charges that are brought against the officer, the municipal attorney will represent the city of Rochester against the officer. So I handle those cases.
Okay. And what kind of experience, I guess I'll put it this way, how valuable has that experience been for you, and will it be valuable if you become the district attorney?
Well, I'm hoping to create what's known as a public integrity unit. So a public integrity unit will investigate misconduct for police officers as well as public officials. Investigate as well as, if the evidence or facts warrant it, to also indict as well and prosecute. And so that experience, that having that knowledge base is definitely valuable for that future use of that office, that unit within the office.
Sure. And when a community is evaluating whether there's real justice, where there's real equal treatment under the law, I think in our second half hour, we'll talk more about how you view what equal treatment under the law looks like in ideal terms and how close or not close Rochester, Atlanta, or how you see other parts of our country operating in that sense. But certainly when it comes to police conduct, there has to be a feeling that if an officer goes astray of the law in any way, that even that officer is not going to be above the law. I want to kind of get your sense for how that would happen under your administration if you're the district attorney, and how you would sort of rate Rochester in terms of that regard. I mean, have police, if there have been mistakes, have police been held accountable?
You asking me that now? Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you said in the next half hour. I apologize.
Oh, no. Okay. I think we're going to talk more broadly about sort of equality of justice under the law, but right here in Rochester.
Right here in Rochester. If you have to set the standard, again, that no one is above the law. So that includes our police. And let me tell you, I have all the respect for what police officers do, hands down. And I work with them on a daily basis, and they are they work hard, and they are out there putting their lives on the line for all of us. When we're in trouble, we call the police, right? But however, there's a small percentage of those who do commit crimes, right? Their misconduct is equivalent, can be found equivalent to crimes. And absolutely, they should be subject to criminal investigation and prosecution like any other citizen in Monroe County. Do I feel that has been done adequately? Absolutely not.
Are there any specific cases that stand out?
No. I just, you know, with my position, I'm not at liberty to talk about any of that with my current position, but I just know that has not happened.
Okay, I think that
here in Monroe County.
And again, listeners, again, she's municipal attorney, so I understand why you say that. But are there any particular proposals, and I suspect you've thought a lot about the police accountability efforts in this community, the different proposals that have been out there? How do you view those different proposals?
Well, what I'm going to say is that I will definitely wait for the stakeholders as well as city council to come to a conclusion. I will, and I will await their decision, and I will implement and whatever decision they make and in the end. It is for the city of Rochester and its citizens to make this decision through city council, and the mayor to come up, and the Rochester Police Department to come up with this resolution. And whatever they decide, me as district attorney, I will follow.
Do you feel like you are going to be able to strike a balance to tell the community no one is above the law, and this district attorney's office is going to operate in that way, at the same time telling police officers, as long as you behave appropriately, we've got your back?
I think that should be understood, but I will definitely, I mean, police don't necessarily back bad officers because they know it's bad for them. It's a bad image. It's bad for everyone. So I think everyone understands that what we say, one bad apple does not spoil the whole bunch. Right. Okay. Police officers do not want to, you know, support people who are bad. They know who they are, and they are not going to rally around the bad apples. They just want fair treatment also in the manner in which their discipline is handled. But we definitely need people to feel confident in the system that we have. I know as district attorney, if the evidence is there, we're going to prosecute, plain and simple. And that's why we will have a separate unit that is what the unit will do. And we'll make sure that it will be a prosecutor as well as an officer, not from the Rochester Police Department, not from the Sheriff's Office, no one from, you know, our New York State municipality, so we can make sure there's true transparency that will run that particular unit.
And I think I certainly understand the point that officers don't want to have the backs of other officers who are doing wrong, because that's bad for everybody. Mm-hmm. But there are times where I wonder if we still haven't really set a baseline of what's acceptable in this country. And I'll raise an example that I asked during the recent sheriff's campaign. I asked Sheriff Patrick O'Flynn about the Philando Castile case in Minnesota. This is a man who legally had a gun, was simply communicating to an officer during a traffic stop, I have a gun on me, you know, and trying to do everything they tell you to do, ends up shot 7 times and killed. The officer escalated that. Mm-hmm. And Sheriff Patrick O'Flynn, at the time, the sheriff, said he was not all that familiar with the case and didn't want to comment and say, I think we have to at least set a baseline. To me, I thought that was an obvious case of not every officer's like this, thank goodness. And I'm obviously not saying this generally about officers. But in this case, isn't that a line? Don't we look at that case and say, that is something that is probably going to have to be prosecuted? Because we're still in a country where that sometimes doesn't get prosecuted.
And I would agree with you. The problem is that we haven't been honest with ourselves as Americans about race in policing. We talk about it, we talk around about it, and it's hinted at, but we know that race plays a part in policing and in prosecution. Plain and simple. And we need to confront that. No one wants to talk about it, but we know that when we pick up, as prosecutors, we know that, I know, because I've seen it done. When you pick up a file and you see the face and you see the criminal history, you automatically are going to make assumptions and to have already decided without even reading the facts. I've been told, it has been said to me that, well, they've done it before, but that's not the facts now. And so we have to be honest about how we look at prosecution, at how race relates to prosecution and race relates to policing. We talk, I mean, there's never been this real conversation. No one wants to be honest. It is race-based. People make assumptions as soon as they pull me over. If I'm not dressed like I am today, police officer may make an assumption. I have had the conversation. You know, we've all seen it on TV and Blackish and all these other episodes. I have a 15-year-old who's going to start driving next, God help us all, but he's going to start driving next month if he passes the permit. But yeah, he's going to start driving. I've already had the conversation. After Michael Brown, I had the conversation.
What do you tell him?
Hands, don't move around. Roll the window down. Be very courteous. If your friends start talking smack, you tell them to shut their mouth. Because at the end of the day, you come home to me and your dad. Plain and simple. We live to fight another day. We fight in court. That's not the time to fight on the side of the road. But you're right. The Castile case, he wasn't fighting, right? And he still died. And you're right, it's a clear case. So I don't know. And with that, I don't even know what else to say to myself.
The reason I raise that is not to say, hey, that's all or a lot of officers. I mean, no, thankfully it's not.
And we know
it's,
that.
It's that we still could have law enforcement officials look at that and say, well, I don't know.
There's not, there, based upon what we saw, and thank God we had some video, right? You know, to see that that was a clear line. But you're right. People still can twist it as we see fit. But the conversation has to, the real conversation about race has to be made. And our police departments are saying that they're having the training as it relates to race. But where we're not having the conversation is about in our prosecutor's office. Where's the training about implicit bias?
Well, if you are elected, do you think that an African-American woman in this job starts to at least change the way our community functions, that parents have to talk to children? You're talking to your 15-year-old now. Does that start to make that change? If we're ever going to have a society where black parents don't have to talk to their kids and warn them about, you know, staying alive during a traffic stop, is this? Do you view this as a step in that direction? Are there other ways to get there?
Well, there are many steps that have to be made. Like I've said, the having the real conversation about race, I think everyone needs to talk about every parent of a child of color, because race and racism will continue to be part of America's landscape. I understand that we've made strides, right? But it's 2019, and we're still in Monroe County with his first African-American just candidate for district attorney, right? So, yes, there are some strides that we're making, but we have a long way to go, because America has to be honest with itself about where we are as it relates to race. And so we're still going to have these conversations. Yes, it's a step, but we talked about that step in 2008 with Obama, right? And then we have Trump. So we have a long way to go, America does, as it relates to race. And so that's just part of our landscape. It's part of our history. But the conversation will continue to be had. And actually, my son was 13 at the time when we first had it with Michael Brown. So we will continue to have these conversations with our children, but police departments will continue to have the training, and on a continuous basis. Prosecutors' offices will have to have the training on a continuous basis for all of this to make a change in Monroe County to look different as it relates to criminal justice.
My guest for the hour is Shawnee Currie Mitchell, the Democrat running for Monroe County District Attorney. She had a number of years as an assistant district attorney here in Monroe County, worked in Georgia. Now she is the municipal attorney with the city of Rochester and running for DA. We're going to get your questions, and we're going to talk much more about her platform after our only break of the hour. We'll talk about marijuana and the debates about marijuana laws, prosecuting, which cases do and do not get prosecuted, and a lot more. So let's take that only break and get right back to it with Shawnee Currie Mitchell. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, is it time for a UBI, a universal basic income? Democratic presidential candidate Andrew Yang says it is. We're going to talk about what a UBI would look like and whether it's needed. In our second hour, we talk to deaf actors about their upcoming performance, Offenses. Join us on Connections. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me read a little bit of feedback from our listeners. One of our listeners on Twitter asked the following for Shawnee Currie Mitchell. The decades-long war on drugs has hurt communities across New York. And he refers to the current district attorney, Sandra Dorley, as what he would call old school. He says they're still prosecuting for possession, which unfairly targets people of color. Would your office decline to charge for possession? Also, will you treat drug addiction as a health crisis rather than a criminal offense, so people struggling with addiction are not trapped in the system? Let's take that first question first there. Would your office decline to charge for possession?
Yes, we want to treat the epidemic or treat the reason for them being in the criminal justice system. So we know that it's due to the addiction is why they find themselves in the criminal justice system. So we won't be prosecuting them for it. We're going to send it to a diversion, which is treatment, and then decline prosecution at the close of treatment.
Okay. And just the view that this listener has, that the decades-long war on drugs has hurt communities, and that there are elements of inequality just in the war on drugs. Do you view that way?
I believe what they're talking about, the disparity in sentencing between crack cocaine and powder cocaine, has definitely affected urban communities, black communities. Up until Obama made the sentencing, the changes, the Congress addressed those changes in late 2000s, 2008, 2010, I believe. Of course, it is definitely gutted some communities because you have individuals who were heads of families are no longer there, young people gone in droves because of this disparity when powder cocaine was of difference. And we didn't treat crack as we do now, the opioid. Now we're enlightened. I'm just going to say that we're more enlightened. We've learned from how we treated crack cocaine, and now we're treating the opioid crisis as a true crisis of people who are addicted, and their addiction causes them to commit crime. So we're trying to treat the addiction and not the offense.
Do you think part of why we're doing that is there's a lot more white people who are using opioids now?
I'm going to say we're more enlightened.
Okay.
But we do know that that it is all part of our America having to take a look at itself in the mirror as it relates to race also.
Do you want to see marijuana legalized recreationally in this state?
I believe that people who possess marijuana shouldn't be prosecuted for it.
Okay, because this is where William writes to us to say, Evan, we always hear about disparities in prosecution rates, especially along racial lines regarding marijuana. But are people really going to jail just for possession?
Yes. They will sit in the local jails for possession charges. Depends on the level of possession. So, yes.
And here in Rochester, we're seeing people arrested just for possession of marijuana.
And that's, yes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And you know, in our current administration has said that they will, if it was legalized, they would continue with the traditional prosecution. And it's not so foreign. We know downstate, they don't prosecute possession charges. Even in Buffalo, they've come out, Erie County, DA's office, they're not prosecuted. It's not strange. It's not foreign. We're moving in a different direction. Possession of drug and marijuana charges is just, we're moving away from the traditional prosecution of such.
Sure.
Especially when New York State is making we're making money off of it. It just doesn't seem fair.
Okay. And so let's assume for a second that New York State does not go all the way to full recreational legalization, that mm-hmm. essentially the system and the law that is in place now stays for at least a little while longer.
Mm-hmm.
Let our listeners know just how much discretion you have, because you say that, you know, you wouldn't prosecute just for possession. How much discretion do you, as a potential district attorney, have?
We have a wide range of discretion, just like I told you about the case where that was an armed robbery.
Mm-hmm.
We can dismiss whatever we want to dismiss. So we could set a policy. But we have to, we take in consideration, you know, how it would affect the community, police departments, you know, in all other aspects of the system, but we can set a standard. Whether it's legal or not, we can decide to set a policy to dismiss.
Okay, let me grab some more feedback from listeners on the phone. Calling from Nome, Alaska. This is Andrea, listening to Rochester News in Alaska. I guess I have to start with why, Andrea. Why? I mean, I'm glad you're listening. It's wonderful. But what brings you to WXXI in Rochester?
My friend, Caitlin, she sent me the link, or that's what she told me she was working there, and I just listened to, like, possibly hear her voice.
Oh, interesting, public radio. So, okay, so you know one of our colleagues, and so you've started listening to Rochester. Okay, you've got a question for candidate Shawnee Curry Mitchell. Go ahead, Andrea.
So, there's been situations where there was reporting of rape that happened here in Nome, and it's not just it's not being addressed by the police, and if so, it's not being handled right away. It's taking months, and there's people not being able to get any responses. How does one make sure a situation like this is being reported and followed through in your community?
You've made contact with the police department?
It's not me who's reporting it.
No, I'm just saying the person, the victim. Has the victim, did the victim go to the hospital and have a rape kit done? Was that done? Because that should automatically trigger police intervention.
I don't believe so. And if so, when, women call the police station and say that they were raped, I think the police just say, who is this and what was this? And
usually
I don't think they tell them that.
Well, I would talk to your friend, and depending on how long ago it was, I would make sure she goes down and speaks in person with an investigator at your local police department. Don't just call in, go down there and make sure that a formal request is done.
And I'm also just going to add, thank you for the call, Andrea. I'm going to add to that one thing that will challenge any community is resources in just understanding the processing of evidence. So we see whether it's so-called rape kits or in Monroe County's crime lab, there's a so-called drug section, a chemistry section where they're analyzing drugs. There is an analysis of rape evidence, and there can be backlogs that go significantly. Are we resource poor in this community? No.
No, Monroe County is pretty well staffed, and we have a great crime lab staff. And they, even when I was over there and needed something quicker. I know rape kits take a little longer, of mm-hmm. course, because it's we're talking DNA and things like that. But the crime lab has the resources it needs to handle the volume that we have. Of course, there will always be some backlog. It's just
sure.
what it is. But Monroe County is in a good spot.
Okay, Don in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Don.
Hi. One of the things that strikes me is everyone gets so upset if the policeman shoots someone running away. Now, when I was young, I was taught you never run away from a policeman because that was his only way of stopping someone. And if you ran away, you were saying you were guilty. And this big deal about police, it bothers me.
Well, Don, if someone is running away, they're not posing a threat to the yeah. officer, so you can't use deadly force to stop anyone.
Then how are the police supposed to stop anyone? If everyone runs away from the police, what we knew darn well that that was the thing, so you didn't run away.
I know, but
if you know the police are going to shoot, the police never shot anyone. Because no one ran away unless they were guilty.
Don, thanks for the phone call. Go ahead, Shawnee.
Okay, well, deadly force can't be used on persons who are running away. There's no threat. You know, police are to use deadly force when they feel deadly force is going to be used upon them. And if you're running away and you're not firing back at the police, deadly force is not authorized.
I'm not sure what the implication of the call was, though. I mean, look at the Walter Scott case from, I think, North Charleston, South Carolina. A man shot in the back as he ran away, running away.
Unarmed.
Unarmed, in this case, because he was scared of the consequences of the traffic stop because of employment and money issues. So this wasn't a case of someone fleeing a police officer in order to do harm, but was still shot.
I guess she was saying, how do you stop people? Police would just have to run after you. You can't use deadly force to stop individuals who are not using deadly force. I think that's what Dawn was mentioning.
Right. And he says that if you know the officer is going to shoot. I certainly hope you don't know that the officer is going to shoot.
I hope not.
Okay. Dawn, thanks for the phone call. Let's move to a question on a subject that's come up a lot in the last year, and that's the bail system. And I want to ask you what you would change or how you see that functioning in the criminal justice system right now, and if the system's broken in any way, how you'd like to see it fixed.
Well, we know that under the governor's budget for 2020 that misdemeanors and nonviolent felonies, police are to issue appearance tickets. And if you don't fall in that category, then it's the same bail recs system that we have in place now, where prosecutors can make a suggestion and the judge would then impose a bail. Let me just say this. You shouldn't have to sit in jail because you can't afford to get out. Jail is not a punishment. The reason we have the Eighth Amendment, the bail, is to have reasonable bail, and that's what the Eighth Amendment says. And even though it doesn't necessarily apply to states, but that's what I teach, so that's a different story. But bail is just to ensure that you will come back to court to answer your charges. That's really why bail was instituted. And so to have people sit in jail because they can't afford to get out is almost basically forcing people to plea. Like, let's get this over with so I can get out of here, kind of thing. And then what if the person's case is dismissed after they sat for certain periods of time? So I believe that there should be a system in place where people are allowed to be out on some type of release prior to their trial, as long as there is no, we can have some assurance that they're going to come back and for their case. And there's no indication that there's some intimidation or harm for the victim. Those should be our two concerns, not as punishment, not the fact that we believe there, there's something else out there, or to force a plea. That is the two main concerns. Are they going to come back? And if they are going to, if there's any type of harm or intimidation to the victim, those should be the only two. So what I think that needs to happen is that prosecutors, which is something we never do, to take into consideration if they don't fall into those categories right now that that has been passed and is in the budget, misdemeanor nonviolent felonies, we should look at what can, if we don't have those factors of the victim and we don't have the factors as it relates to them coming back to court, pretrial release. Pretrial release is a service where there are people who will call and make sure that you stay on top of you to make sure you come back. If we don't have a concern of you coming back, why are we asking for bail? If there's not a concern of you harming the victim, why are we concerned with it?
So this is another case where the district attorney has discretion.
Well, we have now. It's still left to the judge. The judge has the final say. So I don't want people to believe that it all falls on the prosecutor. The prosecutor can make a recommendation to the judge, and then the judge has the final say. But we can. We have discretion to say we're not going to ask for bail, or we're only going to ask for $500, or we're only going to ask for, whatever we believe that the defendant can afford. Or we can ask for pretrial release, where they're pretrial services so they can be monitored that way. It's all up to us.
Tim writes to us to say, a question about bail. Is it true under the new law, no cash bail law, that someone can commit second-degree burglary, which means they broke into your house and got arrested and be released that night or the next morning from someone who's been burglarized and felt unbelievably violated? I hope that's not true.
Second-degree burglary doesn't include dwellings. Dwelling is your own personal home. Second-degree burglary deals with a building. So there's a distinction. So no, that's not correct.
His concern there is unfounded?
Yes, because he said your home, second-degree burglary doesn't include dwellings, which are your home.
Okay. So before the hour's up here, you know, you've worked in a couple of different states, and you teach. You obviously have a passion for that. How do you view Rochester, Atlanta, or other cities in terms of how this country is doing in terms of truly trying to create equal under the law? Is any city doing it well right now?
I believe that we were closer in Atlanta. I felt that it was a... we viewed offenders just not by their criminal history, but by the facts of the case. We looked more globally at the cases that we had. We had a community prosecution office. We were part of the community. You know, the DA, people understood what the DA's office was. So we were out as engaging in the community. And so that provided a better understanding of the community that we served. So that aided in our understanding of equality. Okay. So that is where we have to be and having this better understanding of equality under the law. When you have an understanding of the community in which you serve. It's almost like the conversation with community policing. When you're part of the community, you understand the community. So you're not looking at this as just another Latino or another black person who's committed this. You're looking at it holistically. So we're better to understand, or it's just not another kid out in, you know, the towns who's doing X, Y, and Z. When you're part of the community, you have a better understanding of the community you serve, and there you have a better chance of truly understanding equality under the law. So like I said, I believe me serving in Atlanta was a better model mm-hmm. because of our connection to the community.
And you said as district attorney, you would actively recruit attorneys of color?
Absolutely, because under the current administration, there are over 70-some in the office, and there were only, currently now, there's only maybe 4 people of color as assistant district attorneys.
Out of how many again?
70 or plus. So, yes, the office needs to be reflective of the community that we serve. And then there are No, as it relates to our victim witness department, there are no people of color, not one.
Your attorneys would be trained in racial justice, racial bias, implicit bias?
Absolutely. You have to start over.
Does that training happen now, to your knowledge?
I was never put under any.
Okay. So that's something that you would change as well. And you also say no incarceration for sex workers and victims of human trafficking.
Yeah, we have already a human trafficking court.
Right.
Okay, so there's already some work being done with that. We still have to work to better that particular court system, but most of the women you find in there have been or are victims of human trafficking. So we don't want to further victimize them, but that would again take time to understand what you have before you, and not just another prostitute.
You pointed out earlier this hour that even having an African-American on the ballot for a district attorney is not something this community has seen.
Ever.
What kind of reception have you gotten since you announced your campaign?
It's been positive. Many think it's an impossible task. People didn't think Barack Obama could do it. No one thought that Fatima Reed last year had a chance. But, you know, I was raised in a house where the impossible was possible, okay? And so this is part of my story, is part of my journey, is part of my destiny. So it's been great. People have been warm and receptive. But, of course, you know, you have your doubters. But I welcome it, and that fuels me also.
I hope we can come back and have a conversation with you alongside the district attorney. We are going to welcome the district attorney, Sandra Dorley, separately about 2 weeks from now on this program. And we'll always let you know, not only when we're having those interviews, we will catalog them so you can review them before any elections happen. And we'll send you to the websites if you want to take a look at more about platforms and information. It's ShawneeCurryMitchell.com, S-H-A-N-I, ShawneeCurryMitchell.com, the Democrat running for Monroe County District Attorney. So please come back, and thank you for taking the time to be here with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Our first introduction with Shawnee Curry Mitchell. Our thanks to the team working today, including Don McDonald. Thank you, Don. Always great having you. Juan Vasquez, Randy Gorbman, engineering. That's what they went to school for. Megan Mack, the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a wonderful afternoon. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.